The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to Too Jewish with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Israeli West Bank settler and media figure Shai Ben-Tekoa, a controversial spokesman for the settler movement. We'll also have a visit from our Mevinah on Jewish Ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman, visiting correspondent Rabbi David Wilfond, storyteller Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reform Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reform congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. So the question for today, what is a commandment? In effect, a commandment is a fancy word for a rule that requires you to do something or stops you from doing something. We usually call these laws when they're established by human beings. When we believe they come from a higher source, like, you know, God, we call them commandments. Sounds better and more impressive, doesn't it? This week, we Jews will read the Ten Commandments in the Torah as our weekly portion. It's one of the most famous written passages in all human history. Ten Commandments are composed of about 13 sentences, in fact, and they are at the heart of all Western religion. But what do they actually say? And what do they really mean? What was it like to receive them on Mount Sinai, as Moses supposedly did, or Har Chorev, as it's sometimes called? Before we try to answer those questions about the revelation at Mount Sinai, I have one question just for you. How many commandments are there in Judaism? Most people will answer 10, based on the most famous of them, these 10 commandments, these stars of stage and screen. When inscribed on two stone tablets, they form the second most famous Jewish image of all, right after the so-called Jewish star, the Magen David. In truth, in Judaism, there are not just these 10, but actually some 613 commandments, far more than can fit on two tablets or even a whole IMAX screen. The word for commandment in Hebrew is mitzvah, the plural is mitzvot, and it surely is one of the most important of all Jewish words. In casual speech, a mitzvah is usually translated to be a good deed, as in, oh, he did a mitzvah. But the fact is that mitzvah means command, a law that is to be observed, and the doing of a mitzvah is a good deed precisely because it entails fulfilling a commandment. So, if there are 613 commandments in Judaism, what's there about these 10 that makes them so special? First, according to our Torah and tradition, of all the 613, only these 10 were actually spoken aloud by God to us at Mount Sinai. The rest of the commandments, and there's no perfect list of the other 603, by the way, since we're talking about Jews, and getting us to agree on anything requires a kind of miracle. Anyway, the rest of the commandments are given by God to Moses and then taught to the people of Israel, or even extrapolated from the commandments we did receive from God. But the 10 we get in this week's portion are supposed to have been revealed at Mount Sinai. It's called Ma'amad Har Sinai, literally the standing around at Sinai, and they were given to us very publicly. Everybody heard them, not just one man. So what does this list of 10 consist of? First, the Hebrew name is Aseret HaDibrot. Literally, that means the 10 statements, not the 10 commandments at all. If you count them up, you'll discover that there are really far more than 10 specific commands issued in these 13 sentences, and some of the sentences, the Dibrot, aren't really commands at all. The first of these, in fact, is really a faith statement, not a command. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egyptian slavery. It's central to Judaism. The belief in one God is the foundation of our faith, but you are not actually supposed to do anything at all because of it. The other 9 commandments come down to 4 specific commandments that reflect on the relationship between us and God, Bein Adam LaMakom in Hebrew, and 5 that reflect on the relationship between human beings themselves, that is, between us. Only 2 commandments are clearly positive and proactive, that is, things we're supposed to do. The commandment to remember and keep the Sabbath, and the commandment to honor our fathers and mothers. The other 7 are things we're ordered not to do. Don't worship idols or false gods. Don't swear falsely in God's name. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't commit perjury against another person. Don't covet another's spouse or another's possessions. All of these surely are important parts of the religious moral order established in the Torah. Each one of these commandments is later extended in various ways by the Torah and the Talmud in order to further the great Jewish missions, clarifying the purpose of our lives and creating ethical boundaries for our conduct. You can make a case that these 10 commandments, given in fire and smoke and drama on Mount Sinai, are not even the most important of the teachings of the Torah. In Leviticus, we learn that we must be holy, for God is holy, and we must love our neighbors as we love ourselves. It is in Deuteronomy that we are taught that we have set before us blessing and curse, good and evil, and it's up to us to choose life and goodness. But these 10 commandments begin our journey towards putting ethical conduct at the center of our lives, and of course our religion. When we study them regularly, with commentary, with discussion, we fulfill the mitzvah of seeking to find out what it is God really wants from our lives. When we come back in a few minutes, we'll meet our guest, controversial Israeli West Bank settler and advocate Shai Ben-Tekoa, right here in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
I'm Edmund Marquez with the Edmund Marquez Insurance Agency. Are you looking for a full-service insurance agent who understands your own unique insurance needs? As a founding member of the Jewish Latino Coalition, I understand the importance of making connections in both the local and cultural communities. My family's agency has been protecting people in Tucson for 40 years with auto, home, and life insurance. I encourage you to support a local business while at the same time, take care of those who are most important to you by protecting their futures. Stop by the Edmund Marquez Insurance Agency, located at Speedway just west of Swan, or call us at 323-9333 for a friendly look at your insurance needs.
The world's favorite family musical, a tradition for young and old. Fiddler on the Roof, starring Broadway's Theodore Bickel as Tevye.
one of the most glowing creations in the history of musical theater, Fiddler on the Roof, starring the legendary Theodore Bickel as Tevye.
At the Tucson Music Hall, February 23rd to the 28th. Buy tickets at BroadwayandTucson.com.
We welcome our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Shai Ben-Tekoa. Shai is a self-proclaimed settler in the West Bank of Israel, Judea. He founded and operates the deprogramprogram.com internet radio show. Includes political, cultural, historical, and religious commentary about Israel, interspersed with contemporary Israeli music. He's formerly the lead English language commentator for the Israel National News on Arutz Sheva, Channel 7. He served in the Yom Kippur War, worked on assignment for the office of the Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Shamir, in 1991, ironically preparing for the Arab-Israeli Peace Conference in Madrid that led to the Oslo process, and has been a forthright advocate on behalf of the settlers for quite a while. We welcome back to Too Jewish, Shai Ben-Tekoa. Good morning, Shai.
Good morning.
So tell me what the term settler connotes for you.
We use the term mitnachel, which comes from the Torah, and the mitnachel is one who inherits the land promised by God, which is in the Torah. We also believe that we are no more, no less settlers than the people in North Tel Aviv. It's all the land of Israel, and the objections to our presence in Judea and Samaria are no different than the objections to Jews living in Haifa or Beersheba.
We know, those of us who've studied Zionist history a little bit, that the original goal was to settle and occupy the land primarily through purchase.
Yes.
Is the settler movement's location in Yesha and Yehuda and Shomron and the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, would you consider that by purchase?
Well, after the 1948 war, Israel expanded its borders beyond the partition plan of the UN. There are many areas in Israel which are not allotted to Israel by the partition plan, but in the course of the fighting, the successful defense of Israel, lands were annexed which hadn't belonged. Legally speaking, there's no difference between where I live in Judea and areas of Israel before 1967, which were also taken in war. Especially, I feel about the lands where I live no different than I feel about Arizona. This is occupied Mexico, as far as most people are concerned. As an American, I believe we have as much right to occupied Mexico, which is not only Arizona, but New Mexico and Nevada, which is a Spanish word, and all of California, where all of the names are in Spanish. And nobody is complaining that the people, the professors at Berkeley, have to get out of San Francisco or Los Angeles or San Diego or San Clemente, or Santa Barbara, and so on and so forth. It is all taken in war, and the history of the human race is the history of wars and the changing of lines due to war, and we have as much right to keep the land we took in 1967 as you, Rabbi, have to live in Tucson, Arizona.
So we'll continue with this theme and ask a variety of questions about the distinctions one might make between lands taken in war when we come back with Shai Ben-Tekoa here on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
Looking for a unique dining experience with menu selections made from scratch from the freshest ingredients? The Beeline, located at 621 North 4th Avenue, sets a new precedent with high-quality food and beverages in a counter-service setting. This blend has earned the Beeline the Best Casual Dining Award from Tucson Weekly 5 times. From their perfectly spiced mahi fish tacos to their popular pasta dishes featuring vodka, pesto, or traditional Italian red sauce, you are sure to find something perfect for your taste. space. Try their scrumptious dessert selection, carefully prepared from scratch by their talented pastry chef. Enjoy wines by the glass or bottle, microbrew, craft beers are on tap. The Beeline, 621 North 4th Avenue. Stop by or call 882-7575. Visit their retail location, Time Market on University Boulevard near 4th Ave, with a great selection of over 300 different wines and 100 beers and gourmet foods to go. Call 882-7575 for the Beeline and Time Market. Unique casual dining experiences.
All day long I bitty bitty bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to wear a...
The most thoroughly fun Jewish holiday of all is coming to Tepel Emanuel in the greatest show yet. Sunday, February 21st at 10 a.m., the Purim Extravaganza Show and Spectacular Carnival will make this fabulously fun festival into a wonderful celebration for all ages. It's Purim on the Roof, a wonderful parody of Fiddler on the Roof, exploring the story of the Book of Esther in full musical theater style, including takeoffs on all the classic songs of Fiddler, and featuring a Tevye like you've never seen before. It's a Purim day filled with comedy, clowning, magic, games, and fabulous food. Plus, don't miss the finest hamantaschen in all of Arizona. Everyone's invited, and the Purim show and carnival are absolutely free. Call 327-4501 for information. Come one, come all, to the biggest and best Purim celebration in Arizona. All at Temple Emmanuel, Sunday, February 21st at 10 a.m. Call 327-4501 for Purim Extravaganza Fun for adults and children.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch, or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Well, the TV show The Simpsons celebrated two decades on television earlier this month. They had a celebrity-packed episode that drew a huge rating. In a jab at those who want to tinker with a long-running and still wildly successful series, the episode's plot was set in motion by meddlesome TV executives who forced the show's favorite burned-out entertainer, Krusty the Clown, born Herschel Schmeichel Pinchas Yeruchim Krustofsky, to add a new co-host to his children's after-school TV program. Despite initial tensions, Krusty soon hits it off romantically with a sidekick named Princess Penelope, voiced by Princess Diaries star Anne Hathaway. The pair's wedding plans generated pointed ambivalence in Krusty's father, who is familiar to Simpsons fans as Rabbi Hyman Krustofsky, who can't quite restrain himself while performing their ceremony. Friends, loved ones, says the rabbi, voiced by comedian Jackie Mason, who is also, by the way, an ordained rabbi. We are gathered here today to marry a Jew and a Congregationalist? Is that even a thing? Following an interruption by Bart Simpson, who reveals that he has locked a monkey in the synagogue's Torah room, whatever a Torah room is, the ceremony is called off. But a distraught Krusty follows his beloved to Paris for a reunion. She hasn't yet converted to Judaism, but Princess Penelope reveals her appreciation for Krusty's Jewish roots, proclaiming him her borscht belt baby in the episode's closing scene. Well, Krusty had a midlife bar mitzvah ceremony in a 2003 Simpsons episode, which was called Today I Am a Clown, one of the funnier pieces of TV I've ever seen. And at the end, he expresses satisfaction that sounds kind of like fake Yiddish. As the happy pair floats down the animated Seine River, he declares, I'd rather be a happy schnook than noble schlumpf. The fact that this sort of semi-historical episode of the longest-running TV show ever focused on the issue of Jewish intermarriage is pretty interesting. Of course, Krusty the Clown's marriage or non-marriage to Princess Penelope at a fake kids show on an animated comedy series scarcely qualifies for a deep examination of Jewish life in America. But the fact that this seemed to the genius brain trust behind The Simpsons to be the right subject for a 20th anniversary show tells us a lot about how mainstream we Jews are in 21st century America. Rabbi David Wilfond, first Reformed rabbi to serve in the former Soviet Union, has been treating us to some fabulous stories about the rebirth of Jewish life there. He's back with the final in his great short series as a special guest contributor, a last tale of the revival of contemporary Jewish life in the Ukraine.
You speak English very fluently, you speak Hebrew fluently, but I don't think you speak Russian fluently, or at least you sure didn't when you came to Kiev. You weren't even planning to go.
Right, right.
What language did you speak to the people in?
So I actually used mostly Russian. I actually went to like Russian boot camp at Indiana University. They have this program called the SWISL, Summer Workshop in Slavic Languages. It was created during the Cold War to teach American State Department people Slavic languages. So you sign up for your house, either the Polish house, Russian house, Ukrainian house, Croat house, and a bunch of other Slavic languages. And for 6 weeks, you only speak that language. You can't even
total
have cell
immersion.
Phones. Total immersion. It's really boot camp. At the end of the course, there's a final exam. We had to call up our teacher on the telephone, ask her out for a date, and ask her where she lives, in which neighborhood, and using the Moscow subway map, give her directions how to meet us at the Bolshoi Ballet. So you have to be able to say, you know, take this station, switch trains, go up the stairs, go across the street. The other part of the test is we had to pretend to buy food in the market, to buy like cheese and herring and stuff like this. So I thought, wow, I'm great. I know enough Russian that I can ask girls out. I can buy food. I'll be just fine. Truth is, I had a false sense of confidence that I'd be okay, because once I got there, I went to live with a family in the congregation, and I'm not joking now, after the first 15 minutes, I used up everything I knew. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm in trouble. What am I going to do? Language is a fascinating thing in the former Soviet Union. I want to tell a short story. This man, an old man in my congregation, comes up to me, and he just wants to tell me stuff, and he says to me, when my father wanted to pray to God, he spoke in Hebrew. When he wanted to talk to his wife, he spoke in Yiddish. When he wanted or needed to talk to his neighbors, he spoke in Ukrainian. And when he had to talk to the police, he spoke in Russian. And I was kind of blown away how one man could speak four languages. I don't know if you know this other joke that Europeans say about us. What do you call, I gave it away perhaps, what do you call a person who speaks three languages? Trilingual. What do you call somebody who speaks two languages? Bilingual. And what do you call somebody who speaks one language?
An American.
An American. Yeah. So I grew up as an American. I basically knew one language. Later I learned a few more. But this idea that people speak multiple languages, different languages for different relationships, I found absolutely fascinating. Just a different world. And apparently Jews throughout Europe always spoke more than one language.
Many languages. My grandmother, I know, spoke, I don't know, eight or nine languages. I think all of my grandparents spoke at least four languages.
There's even a Russian expression, the number of languages you speak, the number of times you're a human being.
Because you're a different human being in every language.
Different parts of your personality can come out, can be expressed differently in different languages.
That's pretty fascinating. You know, we think of Hebrew's Lashon Kodesh, you know, the sacred language, and I think for Jews in the diaspora it is. But in Israel, of course, it's the same language that they go to the marketplace in, and they argue with their builder. And
now, a great embarrassment was old people would come up to me, and they'd want to speak in Yiddish, and they'd start speaking Yiddish. And the truth is, I knew a couple words, but I never knew how to
have a conversation.
So when I left Ukraine, I then went and studied Yiddish seriously. Mm-hmm. And I did a course at Columbia, I did a course in Vilna, I did a course in Tel Aviv, and I did a course in London. I did 4 summers of intensive Yiddish programs. And then I learned how to do the best adult education session ever, in my opinion. Well, I'll explain. When I was in Russia afterwards, I would go there and I'd say, does anybody know any Yiddish songs? And people would start singing. An hour would pass in like 10 minutes. And they'd say, Rabbi, that's the most interesting class we've ever had. They loved it. I never said a thing. They just said, who knows what Yiddish songs?
See, I've been missing the boat all these years I've been teaching.
Now you know what to do. That's it.
Thanks, Gingy, for an absolutely great series. We will talk to you in Israel again soon. We welcome our Mevi Nahr, expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Lenman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, I was about to say something to you, but then I had second thoughts.
And third thoughts.
And how often do you find yourself sort of double clutching? You want to say something and then you think, not that I shouldn't do it, or you might feel guilty. That's sort of a Jewish tendency. I think Woody Allen has made a career out of that.
Well, it's funny you're saying that, because both, you know, as a speaker or a teacher, and you know this yourself as a teacher, you know, you...
Also a speaker, you know, just to throw it out there, right?
But you speak extemporaneously, and a lot of times you say things without really having a scripted version of what you're going to say, and
sure.
and you go back over it in your mind. Should I have said it this way? As a writer, you know, you get that privilege of editing.
Before you say it.
Yes. Right. I mean, really, that's one of the things I think that email has done for us. It's given us an opportunity to think twice and three times. But, you know, it's funny because I think the reason we second guess ourselves is because we are so afraid of making a mistake. And, you know, since the beginning of biblical time, we literally have been looking back over our shoulders, afraid that we're going to miss out on something or perhaps make the wrong decision. And I always think about, you know, the quintessential looking back over your shoulder story, of course, is Lot's wife and her escape
into salt.
Right. And, of course, you know, we have this image of the message of the angels that plead with Lot to get his family out of the city before they're destroyed, because the city, of course, is engaged in horrific behavior. And when Lot delays, they grab him and his wife, and the story goes, they take them away from Sodom, and they say, you know, run for your life. Don't look back or stop anywhere. You know, run for the hills. But, of course, Lot's wife just can't follow that advice. She looks back, and as you said, she's transformed into a pillar of salt. And the thing that always bothered me about that story is, like, where is Lot's wife in the story? We don't hear anything. You'd think at least we would have had a thought where she said, darn, I should have listened to my husband. Or, you know, gee, was it really worth it? You know, now I have to just, all this salt? So the question is, you know, what was it about this? What are we supposed to get from that message? Are we supposed to learn that you're never supposed to perhaps think about what you've done, second guess yourself, or is there some other message? And I like to think about that story as really more of a message of faith, not of feeling that, you know, perhaps we're making a mistake and looking back over our shoulder, but that perhaps when we don't have faith in the voice of the angels, you know, when we don't really listen to our inner guidance, then that's when perhaps we really need to stop again and say, wait a minute, you know, is this something I really need to listen to in myself? I mean, perhaps really Lot's wife wasn't so curious about what was happening, but maybe she just didn't know if she wanted to leave her home and family, but didn't have a strong enough belief in God to know that it was the right thing to do. You don't hear about Abraham looking back over his shoulders, but you do hear about it with Lot's wife. So I think
let me just play devil's advocate for a moment. Isn't it important to censor yourself, to think twice when you do something? Isn't it frequently an ethical choice not to just act on impulse?
Well, so that's an interesting thing. You know, tzedek, tzedek, alter dof, justice, justice. Why are there two times? Is it to stop and think a second time to make sure you're doing the right thing? I would say that, yes, self-censorship is very important, but when we have a very extreme message, in this case, a divine message, I think what Lot's wife teaches us is sometimes you just have to have faith in the message and follow that and know that you know, your faith will lead you to the right place. If that message had come from Woody Allen, perhaps not. But that divine message, run for the hills, don't look back, came from the angels. So I think sometimes that's really the distinction.
To just follow God. It's a great message. Thanks, Amy. We'll talk next week.
My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, back from medical leave, and from Two Jewish Storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We visit weekly with Janos Wilder, the outstanding restaurateur of J-Bar and Janos Restaurant. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
J-Bar's got all kinds of great things going now. Winter Harvest Menu, Recession Busters. Tell us about them.
Well, the Winter Harvest Menu, choice of three main courses, great dishes, all of them geared for this time of year, $12.95. And the Recession Busters, which I'm hoping soon will be the recovery menu.
God willing.
Absolutely. A steak. Right now we're doing a New York strip steak, certified Angus beef with all the J-Bar fixing, chorizo, black beans, salsa, slaw, tortillas, $20.
What a great couple of deals. What's the number for the J-Bar?
615-6100, or you can go online, website www.janos.com.
That's J-A-N-O-S.com. Great meals, great prices at the J-Bar all winter. 615-6100, Janos and the J-Bar. We welcome back our expert on the international Jewish scene, back from a little medical leave. Good morning, Tom Price.
Good morning, Rabbi. How you doing?
I'm doing well, and I hear you're doing well, too.
Very well, Baruch Hashem.
Very grateful for. Greece has been in the news for some unpleasant reasons. There have been anti-Semitic attacks. A synagogue was torched. There was once an important Greek community, not such a huge Jewish community now, but maybe fill us in a little bit about the nature of sort of the Jewish community in Greece and what it's like to be Greek and Jewish.
Well, I'd be happy to do that, but I want to put Greece in a specific context. You know I like going back historically, so I hope your listeners will indulge me. And if we flip back roughly 2,000 years to the time of the Roman Empire, when all the Mediterranean was a Roman lake, and all the countries around the Mediterranean were ruled by Rome, Jews were about 10% of that empire, and they were at least 10% of every sizable port city on the Mediterranean, including every port in Greece. Historically, of course, the Jewish community in Thessaloniki in northern Greece was by far the most important of the Jewish communities in Greece, but that dates to the time of the Ottoman Empire, when the Ottoman sultans rescued Jews from Spain when they were expelled, sent ships and clothes and gilded invitations for them, and invited them to settle in certain Ottoman cities, and particularly in Thessaloniki, which they developed into a city where at one point I believe something like 35% of the population was Jewish. That was never true anywhere else in Greece. But if we talk about some of the countries on the northern shores of the Mediterranean, which are Christian countries, as opposed to the southern shores, which ended up being Muslim countries, Greece is sort of particular and almost extreme in the sense that to be a real Greek is defined in the Greek constitution as being a member of the Greek Orthodox Church. And, you know, if you're in the Greek army, you celebrate Greek Orthodox Easter. And there's no sense of ecumenical culture, diversity, respect for other religions, because Greekness is so closely identified with one version of Christianity. So where does that leave Jews, really, anywhere in Greece? It leaves them kind of feeling pretty uncomfortable. Oddly, possibly even less comfortable than they do in certain Muslim countries like Turkey or Morocco. And the places where the incidents to which you refer have occurred recently are places that are largely devoid of active Jewish communities these days. I mean, there are no Jewish communities on Crete, for example. There are probably two real Jewish communities left in Greece, each numbering maybe 2,500 people, and those are Athens and Thessaloniki. But one has a really rich history, culture, museum, several synagogues, whatever. The other, maybe a little less so.
And oddly, of course, it's Athens, the major city of Greece, that has a lesser Jewish community than Thessaloniki, Salonika.
Far less, absolutely.
We will continue this discussion next week. Thanks very much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rabbi Weissman hired a carriage to take him to the next shtetl to deliver a sermon at the synagogue. So the rabbi and driver made a deal and took off. At the first little hill, the driver asked the rabbi to get out and push because the horse was so skinny and feeble and old. Rabbi Weissman got out and pushed up to the top of the hill. Then the driver asked him to help pull the carriage down the hill because the horse was really still quite feeble, and so it went. hill after hill, Rabbi Weissman either pushing or pulling until they reached their destination. Finally, in front of the synagogue, the rabbi paid the driver and said, "I understand, my friend, why I came here. I have a sermon to give at the synagogue. I also understand why you came here. You have to earn your bread, after all. The only thing I don't understand is why we took with us this poor horse." That was the old Jewish joke of the week from the old country. This time, a special feature of Two Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Two Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill.
Good morning, Rabbi. Okay, so after all of this death of January, of the darkness of winter, we get to Tu Bishvat, the birthday of the trees. And it's a birthday, and it's celebrating the sap first starting to move in the trees in Israel, preceding even their first blossoms in the springtime. So I have a story that kind of goes along with that feeling. And I originally heard this story from the Rabbi Gershon Winkler. And he said that one day Rabbi Akiva was walking through the countryside of Israel. And as he was going, a very poor old man came hobbling up to him. And the poor man recognized him as Rabbi Akiva and said, "Please, Rabbi, you are renowned for your deep prayer, for your ability to even work miracles with your prayer. I have a son who is so ill, who is on the very verge of death. And Rabbi, I was wondering, could you pray for him? Could you pray for his life?" And Rabbi Akiva, he felt pity for this old man. He felt compassion. And so he closed his eyes and he said a deep and powerful prayer. And with a certain certainty that his prayer had been received, he told the old man, and the old man was ecstatic. He went hobbling off, thanking Rabbi Akiva. Watching all of this had been a farmer looking on from his fields. And when the old man was walking away, the farmer went up to Rabbi Akiva and said, "Rabbi, Rabbi, how could you do something like this? Who are you to intercede on the will of God? If God wanted that young man to be sick, then that young man should be sick. And who are you to make it so that that young man is not sick? Perhaps that young man was supposed to die." And the rabbi looked at this angry farmer and he said to him, "Excuse me, sir, but tell me, what is it that you do for a living?" And the farmer, "Well, it was obvious," he said, I tend to these fields." And the rabbi said, "Well, if God intended for these fields to be fallow or to be wild, then who are you to intercede?" And the farmer, he didn't have a response. And in that silence, Rabbi Akiva laid his hand on his shoulder and he said, "My friend, we are all partners in this creation, even partners with God."
Thanks, Jordan. We look forward to your story next week. And now, a word of Torah. This week, we read the Torah portion of Yitro, the great moment of revelation at Mount Sinai, which includes the climactic events of the Ten Commandments and the theophany at Sinai, most direct vision of God ever experienced. It is a testament to brevity and concision, a few paragraphs that form the core of Western ethical thought. It is these few words that have become the essence of our religious experience ever since. Important stuff. But I must note that in today's world, the whole concept of revelation is a complicated and challenging one for most of us. Do you personally believe in revelation at all? That is, that God reveals a greater power, will, and plan to us directly? Skeptics, which at heart includes most of us, can easily highlight a series of improbabilities in the central tale of this epical Jewish narrative. First, are we to actually believe that at Mount Sinai, God revealed God's own essence to us directly? That somehow, in some supernatural way, a group of Israelite freed slaves communicated directly with a being greater than themselves, and that this happened only once, and more than 3,000 years ago to boot? Are we also to believe that not only did the Israelites think God connected with them, but that God spoke actual words, and our ancestors not only understood them, but then committed them to memory? Our tradition teaches that there have been moments of overwhelming connection to God, and the greatest of these is this Sinai experience. Our ancestors did believe that God communicated directly with them, that a covenant, a moral contract was created at that spectacular moment. Well, today there are other ways to view revelation. While the text of Yitro, this week's portion, sees the experience of Sinai as unique, filled with dramatic pronouncements, lightning, thunder, shofars, earthquakes, and so on, Jewish tradition has always taught that each of us stood at Sinai, including all the generations of Jews not yet born. In other words, we are all participants in revelation in our own way. Just as we all must see ourselves as having come out of Egypt as freed slaves, so we all must come to understand our relationship with God directly. God's revelation, God's will revealed for us in our own lives, must be given to us and accepted by each of us directly. My grandfather, Rabbi and Professor Samuel S. Cohan of blessed memory, had a concept of progressive revelation. Each, in every generation, has the ability to conceive of and perceive God in his or her own way. Moses' generation called it a revelation. Our generation might call it inspiration, even creativity, a way to channel the divine energy that flows through our world and sometimes gifts us with a spark of greatness or genius. Is this revelation today for you? I suggest it might be. When you feel that remarkable connection to the universe that allows you to create, to write, to sing, to play music, to dance, to love, you're experiencing a kind of revelation. In those moments, God is revealing to you the holiness that can touch your own life. Revelation might simply mean knowing God is present through beauty, inspiration, caring, and love. And that's an understanding that can bring comfort and meaning to everything in your life. Our Jewish Poetry Slam this morning comes from poet Louis Daniel Brodsky. It's called Poetical Moses. Words come to me from another universe as unexpectedly and inexorably as death itself. Those fugitive words fly in from the peripheries to the cauldron's core, shaping the brain's double helix metaphors within a red-hot matrix before melting into fluid music poured onto the page through my pen. Blue ink that slowly solidifies into lines, mitzvot, disguised as free verse, conceived by me, not God. Part of Louis Daniel Brodsky's poem, Poetical Moses. When we come back on Too Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and hear from controversial West Bank settler, the spokesman Shai Ben Tekoa, on Too Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In an awful story, the head of a West Bank yeshiva was arrested last week for his alleged involvement in an arson attack on a nearby mosque. Rabbi Yitzchak Shapira, one of the leaders of the Od Yosef Chai yeshiva in the northern West Bank settlement of Yitzhar, was arrested by the Shin Bet Security Services, which provides internal security in Israel and the territories. At least five of the yeshiva students were also arrested in connection with the arson. In the December attack on the mosque in the Palestinian town of Yasuf, arsonists burned furniture, prayer rugs, and holy texts, and defaced the mosque's walls. That attack led to retaliatory Palestinian violence, including the stabbing of an Israeli woman at a bus stop. The arson attack was condemned internationally and within Israel. Shapira has been condemned for writing a book called The King's Torah that says it's permissible to kill non-Jewish children if they pose a threat or as a deterrent for the future. It says that only a Jew who kills a Jew violates the commandment against murder. This is not Judaism, I'm sorry. Last week, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, called on Orthodox Jewish leaders to speak out against Shapira's book as a perversion of Judaism, which it is. ADL National Director Abraham Foxman also said that it's outrageous that prominent rabbis have endorsed this book. The failure of religious leaders to condemn the distorted views of biblical law advocated in the King's Torah may have contributed to an atmosphere in which heinous attacks, such as the attack against the Palestinian mosque in Yasuf, are encouraged and condoned as being supported supposedly by biblical commandments. In any case, right now, Shapira is in jail. Speaking of outrageous action, last week on radio, Rush Limbaugh made it clear, if there remained much doubt, that he is a stereotyping anti-Semitic moron. Or, as Jewish Senator Al Franken once put in a book title, Rush Limbaugh is a big fat idiot. When President Obama announced he was trying to rein in out-of-control bankers, Limbaugh opined that, to some people, banker is a code word for Jewish. And guess who Obama is assaulting? He's assaulting money people, and a lot of those people on Wall Street are Jewish. What a putz. Why not just come out and say what you really think about us, Rush? We Jews control the banking system. We are all Shylocks trying to get a pound of flesh from good Christians like you. That every vicious medieval lie and slander about us is true. Have you been reading your favorite little bedside copy of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion again in secret, Rush? Marking up your favorite anti-Semitic passages to paraphrase on your show? What vicious anti-Semitic sleaze, all masquerading as political commentary. If Limbaugh had any sense of shame, he would be ashamed. He surely should be. And in news of the weird, a flight from New York was grounded last week when a teenager putting on tefillin, prayer phylacteries used by observant Jews, attached to leather straps, was thought to be wrapping himself in some kind of novel explosive. You would think that a plane leaving from New York, where 2 million Jews live, many of them Orthodox, would have flight attendants who might know what tefillin are, wouldn't you? In any case, everyone was released with an apology. And finally, in a story rich in irony, dozens of ancient artifacts were stolen from an exhibit at the Korin Maman Museum in Ashdod, Israel, including silver coins from the Hellenistic period, a couple of gold earrings, a bronze spear, and several pieces of pottery. The relics were part of an exhibit called, I am not making this up, Antiquities Thieves in Israel. The artifacts had been recovered by the Israel Antiquities Authority from thieves and put on display in the museum. And now it looks like the thieves got them back. And that's the news of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, Shai Ben-Tekoa, the founder and operator of the deprogramprogram.com internet radio show. Shai, Ariel Sharon is often thought of as the father of the settlement movement, and yet he was the one, after all, the town of Ariel is named for him. When he was head of national infrastructure, he built many of the settlements. And yet, in the latter stage of his career, he pulled back from Gaza and from some of the settlements in the West Bank. Tell me about the settler response to that.
Well, I can tell you about their response. I can tell you about mine. I am a sore thumb in the community where I live, in part because I don't hate Sharon for what he did. I understand what he did, and there was logic to what he did. He withdrew from Gaza because he felt that it was no longer defensible. The die was cast in 1994 when the IDF was taken out of Gaza, and you could no longer defend it. Gaza, the fate of the Jewish communities in Gaza was sealed 11 years before they were evacuated. And I personally believe that he evacuated not because he believed it would bring peace. And in fact, there is not one sentence that came out of his mouth promising peace via the withdrawal. What I think he was, still speculation on my part, knowing about him for many years, is that he wanted to change the relationship. So long as the markets were falling inside Gaza on the Jewish communities, given the realities, political and military, we could not defend them. So he calls for a strategic retreat, after which the relationship would change in a military way. The battle would change. We'd be able more easily to defend ourselves from the Gaza after the withdrawal. What happened, though, is he had a stroke, and his plans, whatever they were, because he kept them close to his vest, never came to fruition.
There are communities, really major cities like Maale Adumim, that are technically across the border. A variety of different plans have been formulated to turn over to Palestinian autonomy or authority as much as 90 to 93% of the West Bank, and preserve perhaps 2/3 of the Jews living, or maybe even more, on the other side of the line. Are these kinds of proposals ever acceptable to the movement, the settler movement?
I don't think, whether they're acceptable or not, I don't think they are feasible for this reason. The plans of those who want a solution like this is that the large communities such as Ariel, which has 20,000 plus people, and Male Adumim, which has 30,000 plus people, and Efrat, which has 15,000 plus people, and Beit Arilit, by the way, which is about that size now of all so-called and misnamed ultra-Orthodox Jews, aside from these large groups, they say, we will keep these, and you know why they want to keep them? Because there is no way of getting them out. 8,000 Jews were removed from their homes in the Gaza Strip. To this day, 4 years later, many of them are living in leaky mobile homes. They have lost their jobs. They have been impoverished. Israel was incapable, for whatever reason, of moving these people to a new life and reestablishing them in a decent life. The kids of these 8,000 have become juvenile delinquents. They've gotten into drugs. There are all kinds of sociological consequences to what happened to those 8,000. What, for example, Tzipi Livni says of the Kadima Party is, we can draw lines in such a way that we will only have to move 60,000 Jews from Judea and Samaria. And I ask, and what are you going to do with them? Where are they going to live? Who's going to fund the homes for these people? What new jobs are they going to have? I don't think it's possible to remove anybody in a significant scale. And I return to my image of occupied Mexico. You can also make the case that we have a right to live on the land we captured in self-defense, as Mexico was, as New Mexico and Arizona and California, etc., were taken in self-defense. We have a right to live there. There is those who will say, like a Thomas Friedman and Alan Dershowitz, yes, you have a right, but there's a higher right, and that is the more important goal of peace, and that the Jews really should surrender their rights for the sake of peace, which is more important than Jewish rights. And I am an old veteran of the civil rights movement of the 1960s, when I fought for the rights of Negroes. And as a Jew, I think I have rights which need to be respected. And this will also play a factor in how we dispose of these areas. I don't think it's possible at this point in time to remove 60,000 Jews and put them someplace else.
You know, Ben-Gurion's ideal always was to settle the Negev with a huge number of Jews, as he had been in biblical times. Uri Shani, the Water Authority, they're bringing a pipeline up to the Dead Sea. Water is always going to be a problem in the Middle East, but do you think Jews from parts of Judea or Samaria would resettle in the Negev, given the opportunity and, you know, the kinds of government surpluses that might
Excellent
be possible?
Excellent question. What's happening now is that very process. There are, because the world has decided that the last remaining patch of dry land on the planet, which must be Judenrein, as the Germans said, free of Jews, is Judea and Samaria. It's the last place on the planet where you can say Jews have no right to live there. Because of that and the squelching of new building, the children of the people living in the communities in Judea and Samaria have no place to live, and they, a force of circumstance, are going into the Negev and reestablishing new communities. What you're referring to is underway right now by force of circumstance, and they are the ones who are the real pioneers. They are in the tradition of the Chalutzim. The grandchildren of the Chalutzim, who were socialists and collectivists living in the communes, the kibbutzim, and the collective village, the Moshavim,
right?
They no longer exist. Their grandparents were heroic people who had exchanged their Jewish religion for socialism, and they were instrumental and great people in building the state of Israel. Their grandchildren, unfortunately, though, are way beyond their grandparents and no longer even define themselves as Zionists. Those who picked up the torch of Zionism have been the religious Zionists, which is the community I live in. So your question about the future of the Negev is, it's possible, and I hope it will be redeemed as Ben-Gurion wants, only the community that does it will not be his community.
I want to thank Shai Ben-Tekoa for a fascinating visit here on Two Jewish. His website is deprogramprogram.com. Just like it sounds, deprogramprogram.com.
And you can find out more and listen to him. And hear some excellent Jewish music as well. Thank you, Shai. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be prominent writer Anita Diamond, author of The Red Tent and many other books. Our play out this morning on Too Jewish comes from a long favorite band of mine, the delightful Les Unoirs, a French world music group that features Yiddish songs and two Jewish violinists leading it. This cut is called Hora Kalakaval. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.